this country has had a secret foreign policy ever since the end of the Second World War. And one of the essential instruments has been the Central Intelligence Agency. In other words, we've had presidents, every president since Truman has made great moral pronouncements. But the CIA has been the instrument they have used, actually, too consistently, and in every part of the world. This is interesting. It's not only in third world countries. The first CIA operations were in Europe.
It's Friday, sometime before 6 o'clock, and welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosnick, speaking to you from Coromandel in New Zealand. Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers is here too. This week, a Russian colonel explains what he thinks are the four main aspects of what he calls the coronavirus operation. Firstly, evil. Second, a power grab. Three, economic theft. And four, war on China. And a new documentary about evil in Hollywood and the US news media by former stuntman Mike Smith is out this week. It's devastating. We review that. Plus, the other stories buried by the wall-to-wall COVID-19 coverage. I hope to be back in the UK for next week's show, God willing, and back on FM soon. And whilst our station manager, Pat Hart, has been reluctant to pull us off the air, he's worried about possibly losing the licence. The organised crime networks taking advantage of this crisis might well be rubbing their hands with glee, hoping we stay off the air. Anyway, Martin, welcome. Nice to have you back again. Can you just start by giving us a bit of a take on what one of the, you think, the main aspects this week, the developments in the crisis are?
Well, I think the economic crisis is becoming more and more apparent. No doubt we'll come back to discuss the actual virus aspects of the crisis. But of course, the massive bailouts that have gone on in the US are unprecedented. The Federal Reserve has been merged with the Treasury Department, and they're basically saying they'll print any amount of money to prop up the banks and the hedge funds. And that has led to a surge in the stock market today, even though the Chinese economy has gone into recession for the first time in decades.
We've talked about financialization in the past, haven't we? Even quite recently, with hearing Michael Hudson, the economist, you know, the author of Killing the Host, his view on that. And this really means that the economy is becoming something that happens almost, you know, as you were talking about, in hedge funds, in stock markets, in a virtual way, and has less and less to do with the real economy, which is people working for wages, producing things and paying staff and buying things in the retail sector.
Well, that's why the stock markets have risen this morning over here and elsewhere in Asia, even though the Chinese economy looks as if it's stumbling. And that's because it's just based really on herd mentality. If the Federal Reserve says it's going to print any amount of money and bail anybody out, especially the big high rollers, then you'd be a fool not to carry on betting. Which is
after 2008, you know, that we were told, well, actually, the casino economy is extremely dangerous. It must be utterly severed, a lobotomy between that and the high street banks. Actually, it seems to me what's happened is the opposite. Actually, the casino economy is taking over from both sides.
That's right. And of course, you know, observers like Hudson and others have been saying all along, well, this is a recipe for disaster. But of course, the carapace of normality of capitalist society has kind of been restored. You know, people were working. The economy seemed to be functioning. Everybody knew they were having a hard time and that their wages weren't rising and that they were getting into debt. The rents were too high. But nevertheless, it seemed to be functioning. And we were told that, you know, we were getting out of the crisis and soon things will get back to normal as before 2008. And of course, this has come along and blown all that out of the window. But of course, there's plenty of money to be made from disaster if you're well positioned.
There's also a
rigged system.
Plenty of money to be made by organised crime right now. It's almost like a racketeer's paradise.
Well, it is. And, of course, the racketeers run right to the top. I mean, the international drugs industry is headquartered in the city of London and New York. Of course it is. That's where all the big...
what the situation is in Bristol. We've been hearing that the drug dealers are now operating from supermarket car parks because that's where everybody is and it's an easy place to sort of hide.
Yeah, and if you think about it, people who are addicted to hard drugs have to get their hard drugs, whatever's happening. And if they didn't, they'd die. So, you know, that side of the market, they've had to adapt. I mean, I understand drug cartels operating in favelas in Brazil have taken, you know, because they are effectively the government in those favelas, they've ordered lockdowns and curfews, which the government in Brasilia is unable to enforce. So all of the society at every level is being challenged. You know, what's the real basis of power?
Who holds it? You mentioned Brazil, Martin, reminds me. Bolsonaro, apparently, he seems as if he actually doesn't care whether he catches coronavirus or not. He's been out shaking the hands of the people and reassuring everyone.
Well, his popularity has dived as a result of his position on this crisis. And stuff I've read suggests that the army may be about to move in against him. Because, of course, he was supported by the army. And he's an ex-military guy who supported part of the military junta back in the 60s and 70s and 80s. But the army are getting unhappy with his flaky behaviour. And that
in Brazil, potentially, a left-wing coup. That would be interesting. Anyway,
no, it wouldn't be a left-wing coup. No. It's just him being moved. The army aren't going to remove him and bring back the workers.
Different faction of the right wing taking over.
Yes.
But let's get back to Bristol because it was interesting to see that the police have been reporting, actually after a bit of a delay, that there were a whole load of attacks on Iceland delivery vans and other vehicles around the South Mead area. Literally this is 3 weeks ago when Boris announced the first lockdown. So arson, basically. And, you know, well, I don't know who you think might be behind that and what the motives might be.
Well, I'd have to tell you that the word on the street in Bristol, insofar as I've heard it, is that this is just a normal night in South Mead. This is lads just being lads. And of course, the population at large don't really want their Iceland vans, which are delivering to their families, to be torched by anybody. So I can't see there's much political significance in it.
Out in Shirehampton, a guest of our show from past years, Irina Bondaruk, she's a single mum with two kids. She believes she's had the coronavirus since the end of February, which is incredible, really. And she has, ever since she first believed she got it, and this is why I say she believes she's had it, she's had all the symptoms and she's been ill now, having to stay indoors for 40 days, basically self-isolating for 40 days. All the way through that, she's been asking to get tested, and she hasn't been tested. So she is almost certainly not on the official figures anywhere, and yet there she is with her two children. One is 18 months old, the other one is 7, having to basically survive just with people dropping off and friends dropping off food outside her front door. So before we hear from her, Martin, what do you make of this whole thing of testing? Some people finding it impossible to get tested.
Well, that's the big political issue here in Britain. The government, Matt Hancock promised when they kind of finally got a grip on the crisis the other week that there was going to be 100,000 tests a day by the end of April. They're nowhere near that target. And of course, that's what the World Health Organization said at the beginning, you know, as the crisis got going. And that's how the South Koreans dealt with it so successfully. They tested and they found the people who were infected and they isolated those people, which is why they didn't have to have such severe lockdowns. We've missed that boat. And in actual fact, the political decision was made here not to just to go for mass testing. They've now reversed that. They're saying they are going for mass testing, but they're not achieving the target. Now, of course, the real question to be asked is why didn't we go for it in the first place?
Another angle is how accurate the tests are, because we know certainly with things like HIV tests that there were massive numbers of false positives. So people were being told you've got HIV when they didn't have it.
Well, there's obviously going to be mess ups like that. The real problem is not just that, is it, though? The fact is that it's quite clear that large numbers of people show no symptoms. Some people who show symptoms may not have it. They've got something else. And what they should be doing, obviously, is testing a random selection of the population so we can get some sense of how many people get it, how infective it is, and how many people get serious complications. And unless you're doing testing, how can you find out? In Britain, we're quite clearly a flying blind. We've no idea. And we're not even, okay. At one stage, we weren't even trying to find out. Now we're trying to find out, but we still haven't done it.
Let's go to Shirehampton now and have a listen to hear the account from Irina Bondaruk about her experience of what she believes is COVID-19, but she can't get any medical officials to confirm it. I think you have to make up your own mind whether you think she's had it, I suppose. And 40 days she's been self-isolating now and still can't get tested.
Baby's father, he lives separately from us. And he provided all protective equipment for us, and he was using it himself as well. But he got locked out of his room and his car accidentally. He let the keys, you know, happens. So he had to walk to his parents to get the spare key. His parents just returned from India, which he definitely advised them not to go to. They didn't get stranded. They were happy. They were lucky not to get stranded. They got back. He asked them to leave the key on the lawn. He disinfected the key. He took the key. He went back. And he got sneezed by the NHS worker across the road. He came the next day and he told me all about it, how worried he is now. I went off to work. He stayed with flatmates and baby in a house. 5 days later, spot on, he started showing symptoms. He rang and he said, I'm not feeling very, very well, so I'm not going to come to visit. The next day, so that was Saturday, and on Sunday, the next day, at night, my baby, who was never ill with anything more serious than teething, you know, and a little bit of bogies teething. He never had any illnesses, like any colds, anything major. He suddenly has a fever and he has this horrible whooping, cranky sound coming out of his chest. And he's really distressed. I got obviously really, really freaked out. I got freaked out that it's COVID. Well, because once again, his father already came up with the symptoms. But I also got freaked out, what if it is not COVID? Maybe it's a whooping cough. Maybe it's measles. Maybe it's, I don't know what it is. So I started ringing 111. And that was actually the night when they stopped testing people and put testing only in hospitals. So, in fact, we never got tested. And I cannot guarantee 100% that that's exactly what it was. So, yeah, I didn't sleep that night. We just got told to get isolated for 14 days. That was literally like February 30th or so. It was the last Sunday. It was before March, basically. We got it quite early on. It's been well over a month now. We started straight away administering vitamin C, and he never had fever anymore. He had a cough, ongoing cough, but there was no other symptoms, and the cough is gone now. Finally, after like 3, 4, 5 weeks or so, which is a really long time for a baby to cough. I didn't cough for the first week when I started feeling symptoms myself. I felt like my chest was really heavy. I felt my bronx. I felt more like bronchitis. I felt tickling where I kind of want to cough, but I was stopping myself from coughing at all costs. Although a week later, I couldn't stop myself and I was coughing as well. I also lost my voice. At first, my son, my oldest son, he didn't start coughing as well. He lost his voice. One day, he just couldn't talk. He lost his voice for 2 or 3 days. I lost my voice for over 5 days, where I was sounding more like Marge Simpson, like it was talking was painful. And only then I had cough. And I only had as well a little bit of fever. Like the first night I started feeling this heaviness in my chest. And now I thought it would all be passed and there is like very, very occasional sneezy or something. But just 3 days ago on Easter, like, and it's been over a month now, I started having this funny burning sensation in my knuckles and all my limbs, so both hands and both feet. And I rang about it in the chest today, thinking once again, what could it be? And the doctor said, look, we're just going to have to wait for like a week or 10 days before we can do anything. And it might be still like virus affected. We haven't been tested. None of us have been tested. I say, so it's not 100%, but then considering that it's been a long and very strange disease with lots of different things, even now, like the burning pain in my knuckles and my hands and my feet, it's not something I've experienced before. And it's kind of exploding my mind. Like what is going on with my body and why
is it going on? Maybe Irina, we could finish by you
giving us, you know, your ideas about what you've had. I mean, you know, it's taken a month out of your life. You've had to look after the kids while you're feeling terrible. But what do you think's been inside your body? What is this virus?
I'm not a virologist or a scientist, but I quite like reading scientific research and making some conclusions. And there is a lot of information there. And obviously, I was trying to follow as much as possible and read as much as possible. So what we know about this thing, that it's like pretty nasty and it does kill people of all ages. And it does replace iron from the red blood cells, hemoglobin cells, and overtake the hemoglobin cells. And that's why the oxygenation and people struggle breathing as well. It's not just the damage caused by alveoli. Another thing is, we know as like it can cause weird behaviors in people, like rabies. And then as well, we hear reports about people like trying to spit on other people and infect people deliberately, and a little bit of zombie land, or people raging. And this virus also, like, it suppresses the immunity. And once again, the symptoms doesn't come straight away. Even though people are put on ventilators, a lot of people die because it shuts down other bits of the body. I haven't been out for over 40 days. And then I did had as well one trip to a supermarket with a car, with protective equipment to protect others. Even though it was like well past the initial 14 day thing, I really felt contagious for at least 4-5 weeks.
That was Irina Bondaruk. I spoke to a couple of days ago from Shirehampton here in Bristol, still not been tested. And I think it's a pretty incredible account, actually, to hear, you know, particularly with the baby catching something that sounded very much like coronavirus, Martin, you know, an 18-month-old child with a hacking cough like it's never had before for a couple of weeks. And yet the NHS wouldn't test.
Well, that's because they're being overwhelmed. I mean, this is the problem. The NHS has basically been underfunded for years. They made a political decision not to go for mass testing. Now they've changed their minds, but they're still way, way behind the curve in terms of testing people. And that, of course, will be a big question for the government to answer when all this is over, if it is all over, whenever that
will be. About the World Health Organization, because you mentioned them, Donald Trump has just withdrawn all the funding from them, and I wonder if it's just simply because they won't do his bidding. This is the way that Trump seems to operate, is he's telling them, do this, do that, and if they don't do it, well, that's all the money being withdrawn. And that makes, interestingly, the Gates Foundation, is from yesterday, was the biggest funder of the World Health Organization now.
Well, what's happening here is the politicization of blame. So, as you know, Trump is trying to get re-elected. And one way for him to get re-elected is to turn this whole thing into an anti-China election, which, of course, he did last time. He started a trade war with China. And then, of course, there was the swine flu outbreak in China, then the bird flu outbreak, and then the human flu outbreak. And you can understand the Chinese are still not happy with the explanations they've been given about the Wuhan games and so on. But everybody's been trying to avoid upsetting the apple cart, but that's not Trump's style. So he's upset the apple cart. Nobody else agrees with him. The British government refused to criticize Trump, but they carried on supporting the WHO. Other countries have been much more outspoken in saying that this is outrageous, because this is the WHO, the UN, the International Criminal Court. These are the only institutions humanity has got to deal with certain problems. And the US basically is in defiance of all of those international norms. Which is, well, they could do that if they like, but then they're going to have to pay a price for that substance.
Well, the World Health Organization is stressing this whole thing of testing. I mean, they've been doing that for the last 2 weeks. You must test as many people as possible. One of the reasons that people may not be being tested is that once, of course, it's confirmed that you've had and recovered from this illness, the COVID-19, then you may not need to be vaccinated and you may actually be immune. And the hunt for a vaccine is on, and it certainly seems as if that this is being, I mean, particularly here in New Zealand, where we've got very, very few cases, this is being touted as the great panacea once this vaccine arrives. And there was a report this week from the World Health Organization. I think it was from them. It may not have actually been published by them, but it was a report which was a compilation, because the World Health Organization have been looking around the world to see who it is that's ahead of the game on producing vaccines. The Australian television, just this week, we were watching here in New Zealand, was saying that in Britain, they believe they're going to start human testing within the next, in 2 weeks' time. And in 2 months, that's in June, they may actually have a vaccine, which is, I think, incredible. It was talked about by the boss in the US of the, I think it's Food and Drug Administration, one of them anyway, as that would be a world record, because normally it takes 18 months to develop it. So actually to do it just within a few months would be incredible. So there's a company called Moderna, and they think that their vaccine may be available in July or August. But I mean, what do you make of all this, Martin, the race to get a vaccine? Because there's actually massive amounts of money changing hands in terms of stocks and shares. It's almost like you're betting on a horse. Who's going to get to the finish post first?
Well, apart from the fact that the Chinese are obviously working on a vaccine, and I imagine what the Chinese might do if they get a vaccine first is just hand it out free to everybody and not charge them for it, because it's all about who's going to win World War III. Now, the other thing, the main thing I have in my mind is we've never found a vaccine for the common cold. And I don't think we're going to find a vaccine for this either. And I'm not a medical person. Some people may disagree with me, but I think that this kind of virus doesn't lend itself to vaccination, really. But vaccination is what Bill Gates does, for example. And he's the biggest funder of the World Health Organization as of this week, as you've just said. And because that's what he does, that's what the answer is. The answer may not be in vaccinations at all.
The other thing is that we're told that you can get reinfected with the coronavirus. Yeah. So that doesn't really tally with having a vaccine, does it? So
if you get reinfected with it, and it also that it mutates, then vaccines ain't going to solve the problem. So it's just a big. I mean, of course, if you're going on about vaccines solving the problem, that's something you can sell. And there is even talk that the stock market rally today was on the back of all this kind of happy talk about vaccines. And as I was reading a post earlier by somebody saying, yes, they've got a vaccine based on an extract from Lucky Heather.
The New Delhi study, we looked at this, Martin, back in the beginning of February when it first came out, when the Chinese first released the genome. This New Delhi study is very clear. It's not peer-reviewed, but they make it absolutely clear that in the genome, they detect two different inserts into this particular common cold virus, basically a very contagious common cold virus, which has these two inserts into it. One is a SARS insert and another is an AIDS insert. And what they're suggesting is that this is really not a normal common cold or flu that people are catching. It's actually something which fights back against your immune system, and it acts like AIDS. So that might be why the conventional treatments, like the treatment for pneumonia, aren't really able to cure people of this virus.
Well, that leads to the whole big question, the elephant in the room: is this a bioweapon? And I think logically it could be, or it might not be, but logically it could be, especially if it's been modified. And of course, you see the media over here, the Sunday Mail and various other quite influential voices saying they're starting to talk about it. That it definitely came from the bio laboratory in Wuhan. Now, of course, the Chinese have already said about that they think that it possibly came from the US military delegation to the military games, who actually stayed in a hotel 300 meters from the wet market, which is supposedly the first place where the virus was.
Okay, there's definitely a war of words between, you know, Maryland as a possible origin or Wuhan as a possible origin.
Yeah, if it's a bioweapon, the question then becomes, is it accidental or deliberate?
Well, the Mail on Sunday did a hatchet job on Piers Robinson, I noticed, and he started something called the School of Propaganda Studies at one of the universities in the Midlands. And Piers Robinson is making absolutely clear that we need to have a public discussion and a public debate about whether this is a man-made virus or not. And yet there it is, the Mail on Sunday decide they're going to tear him apart and brand him as a lunatic conspiracy theorist who should be sacked from his job.
Yeah, but at the same time, the Mail on Sunday are pushing the conspiracy theory that the virus came from the Wuhan laboratory. Now, when is a conspiracy theory not a conspiracy theory? Now, it's either a bioweapon or it's not. That's the first question. The second question is, if it is a bioweapon, how did it come to be released? And the military games do provide, because people from that military games were hospitalized with COVID-like symptoms. Seven of them were hospitalized
some people have issued denials about that story, but yes, I mean, that was out there at the time. Another aspect, much more human than what we've been discussing here, Martin, is that the police have found 18 bodies at a New Jersey nursing home. This is, this is old people's homes. We seem to be, I mean, a nursing home, of course, is for those who are more seriously ill than ordinary old people's homes. But these private institutions simply are in denial about the fact that people are dying in their institutions. So they're basically sticking dead bodies into a room, and then when it becomes overcrowded or one of the bodies starts to smell, they're putting them out in the garden. I mean, this is just an appalling state of affairs in New York.
Well, it is, and it just shows the weakness of the social safety net in the United States. But we've got similar problems in the care homes here. The people who run the private care homes have been saying that lots of people have been dying in our homes that were not counted in your figures. And also the other thing they're doing is sending people from hospitals to care homes who may be carrying the virus, but they're not testing them before they send them. And of course, a care home with, you know, shared air conditioning and all the rest of it is a perfect environment for spreading this stuff. And lots of these working haven't got PPE and all the rest of it.
Like a cruise ship, that sort of thing, you know.
Yeah.
That's what you could turn into. So also Edward Snowden weighed in this week, the whistleblower from Booz Allen and Hamilton who wound up in Russia. He's saying that this could be the biggest control grid could come out of this that the world has ever known. He's talking about this as a 1984 for real scenario.
Well, yes, and of course, one of the things that might happen, just like in the David Bowie song, people will be always singing Big Brother, We Want You, because people are scared. It is disaster capitalism to the nth degree, isn't it? People will voluntarily decide they want to be observed. They will voluntarily give their information. They'll voluntarily rush forward to be given a vaccination. And of course, that is, if you're plotting something like this behind the scenes and that's what you want, this is how to do it, isn't it?
But what about Snowden? I mean, he's someone who's an insider. He's extremely worried that this is going to be it's going to be one of the worst things that's ever happened for civil liberties across the planet. And he's not the only one in the United States, because there is this colonel in the GRU, which is the Russian military intelligence, who's been talking about the idea of this being some kind of military operation. I mean, Martin, before we hear from him, we'll hear a little bit of him, and then we can discuss what he's saying. What do you think are the possibilities that this is a military operation, and what's the geopolitical background to that?
Well, I think it behoves all of us to imagine that it might be a military operation and then to logically work through the implications of that. I think that's the main concern that people like us should have at this moment, because not everybody's going to be paying attention to this. The mainstream's obsessed with all sorts of other things. And we need to actually assess, is this a military operation or not? And I tend to the view that it is. But I tend to that kind of view anyway, so it may be that I'm biased. But I think when people like a GRU colonel says this, that what we've got in this country is they set it up a few weeks ago, another little group of British military personnel who are there to deal with the disinformation put out by the Russians about COVID, because they're trying to spin the line that the Russians are trying to undermine the West by spreading conspiracy theories about COVID. Now, that's basically people like us picking up on this Russian colonel, who incidentally has had 8 million hits on his YouTube appearance in Russian. Because in actual fact, we've got to talk about this because of 9/11 and what happened after 9/11. And of course, the anthrax attacks after 9/11. We've got to presume that it's possible that the evil people that run the United States deep state may do something like this. We're not saying they have.
But I mean, on Russian TV, what we're getting in the Russian TV is something different, though. This GRU colonel is saying it is Klatchkov, Vladimir Klatchkov, but the Russian officials on the main Russian TV are saying the opposite. So, Martin, what's going on? Why would they be doing one? And I mean, in the West, they're not talking about it being a bioweapon in any detail at all. But in Russia, you've got on the main TV channel, Channel One Russia, the state TV, you've got them saying, no, it's definitely not a bioweapon. But there you've got the military saying, yes, it is.
Well, you may have different views. It's quite possible. And, you know, the military may have a different take on it than the civilian politicians, for obvious reasons. And don't forget that both the Russians and the Chinese do not want to fight with the West. They're not looking for trouble. It may be, for example, that it's an accidental leak of a bioweapon, either by the Chinese or by the Americans, who then accidentally infected the Chinese through the military games. So it could be that it is really a black swan event, even though it's a military-grade bioweapon.
Anyway, in other words,
reality is stranger than fiction.
What Snowden is saying is that the governments are using, and he's not saying may use it, he's saying they are using it to build an architecture of oppression, of surveillance. So, you know, this is referring really to the contact tracing. As authoritarianism spreads, as emergency laws proliferate, as we sacrifice our rights, he says, we also sacrifice our capability to arrest the slide into a less liberal and less free world.
Well, that's right. But if you think about it, that's exactly what happened during World War II. People voluntarily, or not so voluntarily, gave up lots of freedoms. Lots of people died, and the world was never the same. And that's what, you know, if this trips over into a worldwide economic crisis, and we've already started a world war, really, it's quite clear there's huge geopolitical tectonics plates moving here. And the military will want to control the battle space.
So let's have a listen now to, or discuss anyway, we won't listen to too much of him, the Russian general, Vladimir Klatchkov, on his assessment of what he calls coronavirus operation is all about.
Явление коронавируса, которое ложно обзывает пандемией, нужно оценивать именно с позиции глобальных сил, религиозных, политических, финансовых, экономических и национальных. Явление вот этого коронавируса, так называемой пандемии, еще раз скажу, никакой пандемии нет, это все ложь. Вот. Его нужно оценивать с точки, как понимать, как глобальную, стратегическую, специальную операцию. Именно вот так нужно понимать это явление. Это командно-штабные учения мировой закулисы по владению полным контролем над человечеством. Вот чем смысл.
So what he's saying there, Martin, in this interview, I mean, we won't listen to all of it because it's all in Russian, but you can actually go on to the YouTube interview, which I'll put a link up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk to him and to this. And you can go into YouTube, you go into the settings and then into auto translate into English or whatever your language, favorite language is. And although I noticed, for example, you sometimes get the word ceramics appears in the auto translate, which actually means China. So that's Google, YouTube auto translating slightly wrong. So the translation is by no means perfect, but you can pretty easily make out what he's saying by watching that. And like I say, I'll put a link up to Vladimir Klatchkov, the GRU colonel, on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. So in summary, Martin, he's saying it's got four main aspects to this operation. He's saying number one is evil. He uses that word, and he's basically saying it's a religious thing, that there are people that want to kill other people. And that's one of the things that this is doing. Quite obviously it is, but I was quite surprised to hear a military person putting it in those terms. And he's also saying that it's an enormous power grab, that is to say by elites of power in using governments to grab power across the world. Then he's also talking about it as theft, as a kind of massive basically smash and grab raid in the financial sector. And finally, it's actually the most serious, maybe, which is it's an act of war against China. So what do you make of that analysis, Martin?
Well, I broadly tend to agree with it. And I think it is important that the audience listening and the world understands that a GRU colonel is saying these things. Now, you've got to expect he was in uniform in the in the film, but you've got to recognise that these people are not necessarily telling you everything they know or even telling you the truth.
So I mean, exactly. Sometimes we have interviews, don't we, with a NATO colonel or whatever, and we wouldn't necessarily believe what they were saying either.
Exactly. But on the other hand, it means that it's not just crazy Gosling and crazy Summers who are saying it. It's a GRU colonel who has access to more information than we have. I think that sounds fairly accurate to me, I'm afraid. It sounds very plausible. The other thing I picked up on, Tony, from watching that, was he mentioned 9/11. And, of course, 9/11 is well known by all serious people all over the world to be an inside job carried out by the US security forces, just like the assassination of John F. Kennedy all those years ago.
Martin, let's just be clear. He doesn't say that. And anyway, we have discussed over the years.
Flying the planes.
Yes, but he doesn't say it was carried out by the US. He says it was an excuse for to launch this war on terror.
There's a whole chunk of the section where he talks about the planes can't be flown by.
What I'm saying is he didn't say it was carried out by the US, that's all. And he's saying it's basically an excuse to tear up the rule book of international law and go and, basically invade countries. In that case, it was Afghanistan, and continue to do so in other places. So, I mean, I think that's quite interesting what he had to say. But anyway, look, the implications of a war on China are enormous, really, aren't they, Martin? Because these are the two great superpowers. I mean, it's almost like we're looking at staring in the face some sort of World War III here. John Pilger also has made it absolutely clear, the Australian journalist, who still does documentaries from time to time. He did one on the NHS recently for ITV, even though they tend to be on very late in the evenings after the primetime slots, but probably because they're so harrowing, many of them. I mean, in the documentary he did before that, two or three years ago, it was actually called, Martin, wasn't it, The Coming War on China?
Well, I think that's the background to all of this. The Chinese are basically proposing what is essentially a Chinese-led Marshall Plan for the developing world, because they've developed the capital resources to do it. The US oligarchy are totally opposed to that. And what's happened here is the Chinese economy has been completely defanged as a threat to the US. And of course, a lot of their projects in the third world a lot of the people who are working on those projects are now back in China, and they can't go back to them. So
Hang on, because the Chinese economy is still very strong. They hold trillions of US assets all over the world. They've got masses of dollars. They've still got a lot of clout, surely.
They have got a lot of clout. But it's not. But the point is, precisely because they've got a lot of clout, it's now that they have to be taken down. Because if they're allowed to carry on doing what they're doing, building infrastructure all over the developing world and becoming, in other words, the leading nation, because the US isn't prepared to do that. They just want to rob. They just want to steal. And the fundamental political differences between the Chinese Communist Party and their view of the world and the oligarchy in the US and their view of the world is being brought into focus. The Chinese Communist Party thought that if they cooperated with the Western oligarchy, a peaceful solution for the world could be found. But that's clearly a chimera. There's no possibility of that happening. The oligarchy in the West only knows how to steal. They're not interested in a cooperative relationship with the developing world.
Well,
the Chinese are
not
saying, we will be. But of course, they haven't been comprehensively had their legs broken. Now, that doesn't mean they're not going to be back, but it's a big setback for them.
They're interested in us, aren't they? Because they're caring for us by putting us in lockdown and making sure we don't catch this nasty virus.
Well, the NATO, the oligarchy in the West is treating this whole thing as a means. So they knew they'd have to bail out the financial sector anyway because it was already crashing. This now allows them to do it undercover. But of course, this time they're pretending that they're going to provide help for the ordinary people as well. The ordinary people this time will can see the banks being bailed out through half an eye while they're worrying about getting tested or whatever's going on for them. But they're not going to buy a second time the lie that this has got to be done, but we've got to have austerity afterwards. So okay, it's going to be a big political price when we get there.
Let's get back to the virus. Nightingale Hospital in London has been created with 4,000 beds for intensive care patients with all the equipment necessary. Only 19 beds are actually being used. So it looks like we've developed this massive emergency capacity. Literally tens of thousands of operations have been cancelled and regular treatment has been cancelled. For a lot of people across the country, they've got phone calls from consultants and doctors saying, well, we're very sorry, we were due to do this operation, it's not happening. And what has happened is our hospitals across the country are not absolutely teeming with patients. What's happening is they are emptying of patients, and we're ready for a crisis that would have happened if we hadn't had a lockdown, possibly. But it certainly doesn't look as if we're going to have the intense number of patients necessary for this, and yet many people, Martin, may have been dying because they haven't been getting their regular treatment or have had operations cancelled.
Well, that just shows how we're flying blind in Britain. We don't know how many people have got this because we've not done any testing. So
it's not just in Britain. I think there's many countries, certainly here in New Zealand, there's people raising questions about this as well. Yeah, not getting
New
treated,
Zealand has been relatively untouched. In other parts of the world, it's clearly turning into a major crisis. Because, I mean, don't forget, in South Africa, for example, I was talking to people in South Africa yesterday, they haven't got a healthcare system. They can't lock down. It's probably spreading uncontrollably. Nobody really knows. And there used to be loads more beds in the National Health Service than we've got now. We used to have three times more beds than we've got now before austerity.
Yeah, you missed my point, which is that because all the hospitals have been cleared, ready for this enormous influx of people, there's loads of other people who were going to get treatment that haven't been getting treatment. And this is, you know, it's almost as if the cure is worse than the disease.
Yeah, but the point is that the problem remains the same. Whatever you do, it's going to be wrong in a situation like this. If you over-prepare and you've got far more beds than you need, well, that's wrong because you've wasted money and you've cancelled operations for other people, so then they die. It's all the knock-on effects. The virus is like a ball in a snooker game which hits the triangle, and all the other balls that start bouncing around on the table, and that's all to do with the virus as well. But the virus is just the white ball.
I'll tell you where the balls haven't been bouncing very much, and that's in Sweden. They've still refused to have a compulsory lockdown there. Their figures are now going down quite considerably over the last week or so. We've seen the number of new cases in Sweden going down. What do you make of that? There's a lot of people around Europe pointing to Sweden and saying, well, actually, look, we don't need to have this very strict lockdown situation. They've decided that they're going to actually allow many young people who aren't anywhere near as vulnerable to this virus, certainly, you know, it's not so fatal in the younger people, to catch it and gain immunity. Others are saying, well, they would do that, wouldn't they, because they're already advanced with having a cashless society in Sweden, and that's what this is really about. This is one of the sub agendas. Anyway, what do you make of what's been going on in Sweden, Martin?
Well, I mean, I think what will happen if we get through this crisis, everybody will be looking at how different systems performed and which was the best way to do it and which was the worst way to do it. And in a sense, having different countries following slightly different strategies allows us to look at the different ways things are done. In South Korea, they didn't have a general lockdown. They reckon to have been the best, handled the crisis best, but they didn't have a general lockdown. They just tested everybody. Don't forget, in Sweden, you've got a welfare state very well established, so they feel confident that their hospitals won't be overwhelmed, etc. You know, it's a social democrat government in Sweden as well, which is unusual these days. But of course, the Swedish social democracy, and of course, Swedes are relatively law-abiding people. They're not going out to the big events. They've cancelled all the big events. Anything over 50 people has been cancelled. So they haven't got the general lockdown we've got, but they certainly haven't done nothing. I think we could have a lesser lockdown here if we hadn't messed up the testing stuff at the beginning.
Okay, so also, I mean, looking at one of the reasons, of course, the lockdown happened was because of Neil Ferguson and the Imperial College modelling that was done. Turns out that, funnily enough, both Imperial College and John Hopkins University in the States that's been doing all the snazzy global modelling for the spread of this virus on all the figures, although some of them, you know, some of the graphs, you look at them and think, well, actually, that one doesn't start at zero. What's going on here? Are all funded by the Gates Foundation. Now, John Hopkins University to the tune of billions of dollars, Imperial College to the tune of tens of millions of pounds, Martin. This is where Gates has been putting his money into preparing, and the government have basically been watching what are effectively Gates-funded presentations.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you've got a hammer in your hand, every problem looks like a nail, doesn't it? So Gates, whether this is a bioweapon or not, or just something that's happened, Gates immediately jumps on it as we need vaccines, that's what we need. And, of course, if you're going to have vaccines, you've got to have a big panic. And we know from previous panics that they're pushed, but pharmaceutical companies are very happy to push panic because they want to sell vaccines. And they can't sell that. See, vaccines, if they're not compulsory, then that's no good either. So if you frighten the people and frighten the governments, and then the governments buy the vaccine because they've got to, you can then make money on the vaccine, whether there's a real crisis or not.
Bill Gates this week has said that there must be in the West, right across the West, we must have 10 more weeks of lockdown.
Yeah, well, I mean, I suggest that there's a lot of conspiracy theory on the web about Bill Gates. I think a lot of it is justified, but let's just from a logical point of view, just entertain the idea that he means well, even though he's misguided. I don't accept that, but from a logical point of view, even so, you can still make mistakes because he's missed a vaccine. Vaccine is the solution for everything for him. Most of what you do to control infectious diseases, as we discovered in the 19th century, is you've got to control things like water supply, having everybody with some decent accommodation to go back to so that they can self-isolate and so on. These kind of things are far more important ultimately than fixes from the medical sector.
Okay, so look, let's go back and have a look at the bit more of the geopolitics of all of this. But starting, and the media coverage chatting to Dr. Judith Brown from Bristol, who's been part of the Stop the War movement in the city for many years. She was formerly had a job as a nurse herself, and then also got a PhD and went out working for the United Nations in Yemen, out there as an aid worker before the Yemen war started. But the reason I wanted to speak to her is because she has some things to say about the Asian flu, which was happened in 1957-1958, where several of everybody caught it, and actually someone in her street died of it. And she also here talks about this whole business of the Spanish flu and its relationship with the First World War. This is back in the days where these flus were just accepted as part of life. So anyway, here's Dr. Judith Brown now speaking to me a couple of days ago.
My name's Judith Brown. I spent time as an aid worker overseas. I'm now a retired person, and I did a PhD in media coverage of Arab issues. And in that, I looked at the way that the media is controlled. So when new discourses appear on the media, I'm always interested. I don't object to advice being given. I don't object to people choosing to self-isolate. I don't object to reasonable suggestions. What I'm really shocked at is the fact that the media seems to be covering the COVID virus to the exclusion of all other news, to the extent that people are really, really terrified. Ordinary people that normally go about their lives in a very carefree way are absolutely terrified of getting this virus. And having lived through pandemics before in 1957, I didn't see this extent of fear. And I also dislike the draconian laws that are being introduced all over the world.
Well, most people don't remember 1957.
Well, that was the Asian flu. I think there were 5 million people who died worldwide. It was a time when there wasn't so much interactions and movements throughout the world, which probably kept the death toll down. But certainly almost everyone that I knew seemed to get it, and there were a lot of people that died, including, for example, a young person that died in our street. But still, none of the neighbours and my mother seemed to panic about it. They accepted that it was flu and it was serious, but there was no panic. People continued their lives as best they could.
I know you've also talked about the 1918, the Spanish flu at the end of the First World War. That was actually killed more people, I believe, didn't it, than the war itself? And yet, of course, we don't really remember the Spanish flu. We remember the First World War, though, in a much bigger way.
Yeah, although I think that the figures after the First World War were 50 million deaths worldwide, but since it's been reviewed to 100 million. Whereas there were about 20 million deaths caused by the fighting in the war itself. So you're talking about maybe five times as many deaths than the flu epidemic. Of course, the flu epidemic may have helped the war to end and saved lives from the conflict, of course. And it was the fact that people were being moved around the world that made the figures maybe larger than they would have been otherwise.
Now, your expertise is in the media and the way that they represent various conflicts, and I suppose this is a conflict between humanity and a virus.
And the story is that this is a very dangerous virus. It's not a nice virus, but on the other hand, flu isn't a very nice virus. I've, in my earlier nursing career, I've nursed many people, young and old, that have died with flu, and it tends to affect their lungs, and it's a horrid condition. And so is the coronavirus. If you look at how it's been presented, for example, a lot of people don't know that 15 to 20% of the common colds are caused by the coronavirus. They think that this is something that is completely new. It's a different variety of the virus. So people see it as something that's sort of like really alien, and the message certainly is, because it's so serious, you've got to do everything that the government says. And that is the issue that comes over time and time again. And in terms of discourses, there are there always have to be discourses of dissent that are allowed, but those discourses of dissent are things like, for example, whether the government dealt with the condition quickly enough. They're sort of like peripheral issues. You can't, I mean, your issue, for example, the possibility of this was a manufactured virus. My issue of the fact that the seriousness has been taken out of context. These sorts of issues aren't allowed to be discussed on the media.
You've said, haven't you, that you believe that some journalists have actually been arrested for talking about these things?
Democracy Now, there was a discussion, and they're going to put updates out on a weekly basis. But one of the things that they've listed is countries where journalists have actually been imprisoned for trying to raise alternative discourses, Turkey being one of those. There was a number of countries, but I can't remember all of them.
What about Yemen? Because I know I think you actually were working for the UN in Yemen, and they amazingly have welcomed the coronavirus. Why is that?
What they're hoping is that if the coronavirus spreads, it's going to stop the fighting on the ground. It isn't happening so far, I have to say. Saudi Arabia called a ceasefire, and the next day dropped 23 bombs, which isn't a particularly good start to a ceasefire. But I think that people are hoping that if the coronavirus spreads, it will actually stop people from fighting on the ground, and that will give people a chance to really seriously talk peace. So, and if that happened, of course, it would be a very good outcome. On the other hand, of course, the aid agencies that are providing aid and medical care to Yemen, they're very distressed about it, because the medical services have been decimated. And Yemen is also, is already suffering a huge number of epidemics. Cholera, of course, being the worst. Diphtheria, dengue fever, malaria, diseases that that weren't that common in Yemen when I was there are now killing people in large numbers. If the media was really interested in people dying, they would highlight every day the terrible conditions under which Yemenis are living, which must be the worst in the world now. And yet they're not interested in that, and neither is the government, because although they've been told that they've got to stop supplying weapons that are facilitating this war, of course, they are still providing weapons under existing contracts, and also physical help in Yemen, in Saudi Arabia, in terms of running the war machine, and even to the extent of loading bombs onto warplanes. So I think that people are in Yemen are just hoping that if the virus does take place there, that it will help to end the war.
I've sort of read two stories, really, and one story is that maybe we should rethink globalization and maybe rethink going back on a lot of the links between governments, and individual governments should have much greater power, and the people in those countries should have much greater power. And then the other issue is, like Kissinger said, and I think other people as well, is that in order to control a pandemic, you've got to have overall control. But in a sense, Tony, and I'm sure that you have thought this yourself, that the we don't have empire now, instead of which we have a hegemony, and the world power is America, and it's controlling the world through globalization. So it wouldn't be at all surprising if those in power tried to increase their power by not having a de facto world government, but actually making it a reality. I've no objection to people isolating, self-isolating. I'm just against things that take our human rights away. And you know, where people talk about exceptionalism, for example, there was a Scottish Member of Parliament that visited a holiday home. Now, if she lived in her own home, drove to her holiday home, and there was no one else there, and she sat in the car all the time on the way to her holiday home, I can't see that that put anybody at risk. I don't see why you should have this draconian pressure in order to make people comply, why people can't be flexible in terms of rules in order to suit their own circumstances.
And there is this whole term, essential services, that's been invented, really, during this crisis. We hear that someone coming to fix your internet is an essential service, but going to visit a dying parent or loved one is not essential.
Yes, exactly. And I think that, for example, if someone's mother was dying, they, whether or not it was with coronavirus, they might wish to take the risk of having coronavirus in order to give their mother a better death. And I think that should be something that where individuals should be able to take their own choices.
And one does wonder, you know, who will be the first person to be fined or jailed for visiting a dying relative. Amazing situation we're in. But anyway, Judith Brown, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And that's Dr. Judith Brown from Bristol, part of the Stop the War movement, and also a former UN aid worker in Yemen. And as she also said there, a former nurse. Martin, she's saying that these sorts of things happened in the past. There was no big crisis about it, but there she's also talking about the geopolitics of it, and saying that, well, effectively, why, if governments care about people dying, haven't they been doing something about the far worse epidemics of cholera, typhus, dengue fever, etc., in Yemen, not to mention the indiscriminate bombing of UNESCO sites and hospitals and all the basic infrastructure of Yemen being bombed?
Well, the simple answer is that Yemen is poor and a victim of imperialism. And, you know, posh people can get coronavirus. Boris Johnson's had it, and therefore it's a real crisis.
Also, there's been protests, haven't there? There's not been much about that on the TV around the world. We've seen in Vancouver in Canada. We've seen in Michigan, in the States, Ohio, in the United Arab Emirates, in China, most definitely in France. The Gilets Jaunes, the Yellow Vests, have decided, it seems, to restart their protests on Saturdays. And they've been having gatherings which defy the lockdown outside Montparnasse station in Paris. There does seem to be a bit of a attempt for protesters, Martin, to actually just do a bit of civil disobedience, I suppose, and say, well, look, we're not taking any notice for a little while of your lockdown and the physical distancing rules, the social distancing rules. Ohio had the best slogan, which was just Open Ohio. That was their hashtag. Open Ohio. We want everything working again. And obviously there are people who are just running out of money, whether it's to pay the rent, etc. And this is going to drive, surely, more and more people onto the streets, a desperate need for food and for some kind of income.
I don't think the people in Michigan who were mostly Trump supporters waving Trump banners were people running out of food. I think Trump has said today that they're going to open up the U.S., Now, we will see what happens to the death count when he does that. This is a big, the same issues on the table here. Keir Starmer's called for the government to give a clear indication of how lockdown is going to end, and the government's, sixes and sevens on it. The problem is, as in China,
Martin, has Starmer got a policy, or is he just
asking?
Well,
what he's trying to do is put the government on the spot. He hasn't got a policy, he knows they haven't got one either. So he's trying to find out, he's trying to expose the fact that they haven't got one. Because he knows, you see, the pressure on the right wing, from the right wing in the US and Britain, is to get the lockdown over with. Let's get back to business. But of course the pressure from the other side is quite strong as well. Lots of people now in this country, I'm telling you now, are genuinely scared. Bus drivers are genuinely scared. People I know who are working in hospitals in my family are genuinely scared.
What about this aspect that I talked about with Judith about this whole thing of what is an essential worker? It does seem a little bit hypocritical to allow someone to come into your home. I mean, I don't know what the situation is in the UK. Hopefully we'll find out next week. But here in New Zealand, someone can come into your home and fix your internet, because that's considered to be an essential service and they don't need to wear a mask. And yet if your elderly parent is dying in a nursing home or in a care home, you're not allowed to go and say goodbye to them. It just does seem as if what is an essential task and what isn't is a rather arbitrary. It almost seems as if it's made up on the back of an envelope.
Oh yes. I mean, the society has had to question what is essential and what's not essential, hasn't it? I mean, it turns out, for example, that doctors and nurses working on the front line, they can be identified as essential, but actually the care home workers are just as essential. And, of course, they're very badly paid, often agency staff. They work in more than one care home. And as they go from care home to care home, they're spreading the virus. But, of course, the essential workers are the ones who are actually in the streets, the people collecting the bins. Somebody got to do that, otherwise other things are going to happen. But of course, the inessential workers are all the people working in IT and creative industries and political journalism who are sitting at home tapping away on their keyboards. They're not essential, are they?
Anyway, look, we were talking a bit about Bill Gates, and the Gates Foundation seems to have the plan, which most governments of the world have one or other version of, which they're following with this lockdown. And Robert Kennedy, who is, I believe, a nephew of the assassinated President John F. Kennedy, did an absolutely blistering attack on Gates and on his whole way of dealing with this. And it was read out by Bill Still, the author and director of a film called The Money Masters and various other films about money. So here's Bill Still now commenting on Robert Kennedy and his assessment of the Gates Foundation. And he's really looking at some of the financial interests and political interests of Bill Gates.
Yesterday, Robert F. Kennedy, an American environmental attorney known for his non-political humanitarian work and the nephew of former President Kennedy, wrote an article blasting the role of Microsoft founder Bill Gates for his questionable experimental vaccine programs in remote parts of the world. Gates' obsession with vaccines seems fueled by a messianic conviction that he is ordained to save the world with technology and a godlike willingness to experiment with the lives of lesser humans. RFK then listed the horrible record of Gates' international vaccine failures. Gates, through his foundation, promised to eradicate polio, at least in India, and spent $1.2 billion trying to do so. Gates mandated a new polio vaccine program of 50 vaccinations per child before age 5. The normal polio vaccination routine was only 5 per child. According to RFK, the result was catastrophic. Indian doctors blamed the Gates campaign for a devastating vaccine strain polio epidemic that paralyzed 496,000 children between 2000 and 2017. In other words, the 17-year program somehow caused a vaccine-related strain of polio to proliferate. In 2017, the Indian government dialed back Gates' vaccine regimen and evicted Gates and his cronies from the NAB. Polio paralysis rates dropped precipitously. In 2017, the World Health Organization reluctantly admitted that the global polio explosion is predominantly a vaccine strain coming from the Gates vaccine program. But it wasn't just India that was affected. By 2018, 75% of all polio cases worldwide were from the Gates vaccines. In 2014, the Gates Foundation funded tests of experimental HPV vaccines developed by GSK and Merck on 23,000 young girls in remote Indian provinces. Approximately 1,200, or 5.2%, suffered severe side effects, including autoimmune and fertility disorders. 7 died. Indian government investigations charged that Gates-funded researchers committed pervasive ethical violations, pressuring vulnerable village girls into the trial, bullying parents, forging consent forms, and refusing medical care to the injured girls. The case is now in the country's Supreme Court. Another Gates vaccine experiment was conducted in 2010 in Africa to prevent malaria. Of 5,000 children given the Gates vaccine, 151 died, and over 1,000, 20%, had serious side effects, including paralysis and seizures. In 2002, in a program called MenAfriVac, Gates forcibly vaccinated thousands of African children against meningitis. Between 50 and 500 children developed paralysis. South African newspapers complained, "We are guinea pigs for drug makers." Nelson Mandela's former senior economist, Professor Patrick Bond, described Gates' philanthropic practices as ruthless and immoral. In 2010, Gates openly joined the depopulation movement. Gates committed $10 billion to the WHO, promising to reduce the world's population in part through new vaccines. A month later, Gates told a TED Talk that new vaccines could reduce population. In 2014, Kenya's Catholic Doctors Association accused the WHO of chemically sterilizing millions of unwilling Kenyan women with a phony tetanus vaccine campaign. independent labs found the sterility formula in every vaccine tested. After denying the charges, WHO finally admitted it had been developing the sterility vaccines for over a decade. According to Kennedy, Gates uses his fortune to control the agenda of the WHO, UNICEF, and other organizations. In addition, Gates's money funds big pharma companies that manufacture vaccines and a massive network of pharmaceutical industry front groups that broadcast deceptive propaganda, develop fraudulent studies, conduct surveillance and psychological operations against vaccine hesitancy, and use Gates's power and money to silence dissent and coerce compliance.
So that was Bill Steele. His program is The Steele Report, really just going through Robert Kennedy's article about Bill Gates. And I suppose the other thing on the geopolitics of all this, Martin, is looking at over to the Middle East. You know, things don't really seem to be calming down in Syria. We would hope they would, but they don't seem to be. And in the meantime, we hear this week that Benjamin Netanyahu's trial for corruption, he's up for 7 counts of fraud, bribery and lying, effectively, which is just breach of confidence of some kind and saying he was going to do something when he didn't do it, promising to. So anyway, 7 counts, criminal charges against Netanyahu. Oh, they've delayed the trial for 2 months now, citing that if they do conduct that trial, it would cause serious harm to public health.
Well, I mean, obviously, everybody is grasping at this health emergency to cover their own backsides, just as they did after 9/11. All of these people all over the world say, oh, we're fighting terrorism. That's what we're doing. And of course, that just covers up whatever else they were doing. And of course, everybody out there, there's loads of scams going around on the internet of people pretending to give advice, help, whatever, and basically taking money off people. There's always going to be vultures, and Netanyahu's a vulture, and he's taking advantage of the situation.
What do you make of what's going to happen there, though? Because they've had a kind of electoral impasse. It's almost like Israel is turning into a dictatorship, because these elections are all, you know, actually, a similar kind of thing has been happening in Ireland, because the Irish government hasn't been formed. You've basically got Vladka running things as it was before the general election. So there are aspects of this, which, including, of course, the cancellation of elections in Britain for a year, which begin to look a little bit like democracy is slowly crumbling under these lockdowns.
Well, there never was much anyway, let's face it. And this emergency situation allows those who don't want democracy to, for their own reasons, to try and wriggle out of any kind of accountability. That goes with the territory, doesn't it?
Also this week, one of the bits of buried news we really must look at is the report about the way that the anti-Semitism scandal was dealt with by Labour officials, Martin. Absolutely shocking to see. It was the report on anti-Semitism is not going to go to the Equalities and Human Rights Commission, because basically there's nothing really that much to see in it. So it looks as if there was a lot of hot air about Labour and anti-Semitism before the general election in December. But most importantly, you've got what looks like a sizable number of Labour officials who are paid by your subscriptions to the Labour Party and others, obviously, who were actually actively working against Jeremy Corbyn from within Labour Party's offices. Unbelievable, really, to see that people who are paid to be trying to win an election for Jeremy Corbyn were doing precisely the opposite. They didn't want him to win the general election.
Well, you know, I'm not particularly surprised by any of this. We pretty much knew that was the state of affairs. The politics around this report is that the report was done and it was going to be sent off to why this body is investigating the Labour Party for anti-Semitism, I really don't know. It's completely absurd. But of course, it's all part of the, you know, political manipulation that goes on in this country, orchestrated largely by the Israeli embassy. And the report is leaked.
What evidence do you have for that?
Well, the Al Jazeera sting on the people who are at the heart of this allegation.
That was 2 years ago.
No, but I mean, the same people are these people that were carrying, the ones in the report are the same people who were talking about this, basically the Jewish labour movement and Ian Nichols and the Blairites are all the same people, Tony. And that's what's been going on all along. They've been sabotaging the Labour Party for various reasons, because they're basically pro-NATO and pro-Israel. That's why they've done it. This report was going to be buried, and it was leaked by the people. Well, it was leaked somehow. And of course, Starmer was then handed the bomb. And of course, that is actually the payback from people in the Labour Party who've been wrongly accused of anti-Semitism and so on. It turns out that Nicol and others were deliberately stringing out allegations of anti-Semitism to keep it in the news to undermine Corbyn. So they weren't resolving issues that had supposedly been presented. And of course, this from a psychological warfare methodology works perfectly well. The fools
so,
hang on, nothing. Imagine it's an anti-Semitism problem.
You're suggesting there that psychological warfare is being applied to the British Labour Party, and that the democracy is thereby being totally undermined in this country.
Well, it goes back a long way. Harold Wilson was run out of power by the deep state in Britain because of his failure to support the US in Vietnam. If that was happening in the 1960s, you can imagine what goes on today. It's pretty clear that we don't have a fully democratic system. Not least because we don't have like in New Zealand, a proportional system which would allow different tendencies free play. If you've got the Labour Party as basically a forced marriage between the left and the right, then it's bound to turn into a squabble. Whereas in other countries, Denmark, Ireland, there'd be two different parties, and everybody could hear what different parties had to say.
I mean, we did, before I came out to New Zealand, we pointed out that Keir Starmer, when he was Director of Public Prosecutions, did all sorts of terrible decisions, one of which was stopping the Crown inquiries, the basically criminal prosecutions of MI5 and MI6 for torture in various cases. And also, now, I mean, I'm not 100% sure of, but there's even allegations that he stopped the inquiry into Jimmy Savile too. So there's a lot of people pointing the finger at Starmer and saying, well, basically, you're just an establishment stooge when you were Director of Public Prosecutions.
Well, I mean, let's face it. Compared to Jeremy Corbyn, he is an establishment stooge. But that's what the Labour Party membership have decided to go for, because, you know, you can only bang your head on a brick wall for so long. And the party's decided to trust Starmer. I don't like his track record on various things. But on the other hand, what's the alternative? Of course, that's because we're in a no-win situation, whatever we do. We need to change the electoral system.
I mean, but I mean, there's a lot of people now talking about, well, saying, well, the Labour Party has had it, because it's a bit like when Tony Blair first arrived. A lot of people are leaving the Labour Party, and they're saying, well, what we want is a new party around maybe people like Jeremy Corbyn, people like Ken Livingstone, people like George Galloway, the other people, and Chris Williamson, who were booted out as part of this crisis. We can form a new party there.
No, you can't. The British system won't allow it. You can form one, but it won't get anywhere. We're stuck with the system we've got. Apart from, of course, in Northern Ireland, where the Labour Party doesn't organise. In Scotland, where they've been wiped out by the SNP. And, of course, in Wales, you've got the Labour Party is still hegemonic.
Well, just with UKIP, when UKIP, I mean, obviously they didn't have any MPs, but UKIP, when that was infiltrated by Tommy Robinson, Nigel Farage just stepped sideways and said, right, we're forming a new party. It's called the Brexit Party.
Yeah, but which did absolutely nothing in the general election on the first past the post.
But yes, but it did very, very well in the European elections, for example, didn't it?
All right,
it?
Well, the Labour Party doesn't, if we formed a left-wing party, to fight, we can't fight European elections anymore because we're not in the European Union. You could imagine that a left wing of the Labour Party, you know, could do something in European elections, but we don't because that's under PR. But under first past the post in Westminster elections, if you don't keep team discipline like in rugby or football, then you don't win. You just lose the ball.
Okay, let's have a look at some of the other stories this week as well, which may not have been heard much about because of the wall-to-wall COVID coverage by the mainstream press. Parties have been calling for Parliament to return, Martin. Is it justified to have no Parliament during this crisis? Couldn't they meet by on Zoom or something and meet virtually?
That's what they're preparing to do. That's what they're preparing to do. They're preparing to have a Zoom meet-up in Parliament.
The Zoom Parliament. Well, we'll see what happens there.
I mean, the problem in Britain is that because of the archaic nature of our institutions, you have to have physically people there to vote and all the rest of it. Whereas, of course, in other parliaments, they've had electronic voting for MPs for years.
Well,
they don't actually physically turn up.
Electronic voting is an absolute wonderland for hackers. I mean, we know this, but that's actually there is something quite nice about the idea that you have to actually be physically there and put a go through a ballot box or go through one of the lobbies in order to count a vote. And it's not done remotely and it's not hacked. But anyway, look. Judges are getting a £60,000 pay rise as well. So one does wonder if this is a bit of a bung because, you know, we're seeing what's been going on with the Julian Assange case. And I've seen people saying, well, look, if the Assange is extradited or if anything happens to him, he's even, you know, jailed any longer. That means really the end of the rule of law in Britain. That is it. No more rule of law.
Well, I would tend to agree with that. The Assange case, of course, completely swamped in this in the crisis, but it is very important. As I said last week, it's like the canary in the mine. The habeas corpus has been completely overturned here. He has committed no offence in British law, and therefore he can't be extradited.
When you say habeas corpus has been overturned, what do you mean by that?
Well, habeas corpus was brought in Magna Carta in 1215, so that if somebody is arrested, they must be charged and put on and basically go to a fair trial of their peers. This is not happening in Assange case at all, because he's not committed any crime in Britain at all. He's not committed any crime in Sweden, according to the Swedes. And he's not committed any crime under British law. He's been charged in the US of treason via espionage to the United States of America, even though he's a citizen of Australia. How does that make sense? How can you be a traitor to the US if you're not a US citizen? Well, that means the US is basically saying anybody who disagrees with us anywhere in the world, we can try them for treason to us. Absurd. Any lawyer in Britain would just say this is absurd. But
he has revealed incredible amounts of stuff. I mean, actually, even we were talking about Pizzagate, and we will be a little bit more later. But he was it was WikiLeaks that revealed a lot of the emails in the Pizzagate scandal. But one of the most important things was the Vault 7 scandal, which I think was from memory about 3 years ago, 2017. Where he revealed that the CIA were using hacking techniques, not just to hack elections in this case, they were using them to hack trains, that is locomotives on trains, they were using them to hack aircraft and cars in order to cause crashes to assassinate people. Now, this is no mean thing to leak the documents that are proving that. It was also shown in Vault 7 that the various televisions, even though we were on standby, it was possible to listen into all the conversations that had been going on in that room. So this is Assange's work, and he's being rewarded with it by being incarcerated in Belmarsh as a terrorist.
Well, in a sense, it's a kind of backhanded compliment, isn't it? He's actually exposed an awful lot of what they do, and he's now paying the price. But he's a far better man than they are.
Do you think he'll be extradited to the US or not? Have the British establishment...
Well, I would have thought... I'm not a lawyer, but I would have thought that there cannot be a basis in British law, common law, for him to be extradited. But what you've got is a completely politicised process whereby the judges in charge of his case have links to the military-industrial complex here, and he's basically being held in administrative detention by the British state without recourse to a real court. And that, of course, is in defiance of everything that British democracy and rule of law is supposed to stand for. We've got it in all the states I work in that we are a country of laws. Clearly not the case.
I would just urge our listeners to, track down the various ways that there's all sorts of ways that you can help out with the Assange case, not least of which is to support the campaign to get him out. Anyway, also, Martin, Ian Crane, I mean, we talked a little bit, we touched on talking about 9/11 earlier, but Ian Crane is seriously ill. He ran a series of conferences, I think there were 7 or 8 or even 9 of them, called Alternative View, which were very, I mean, you know, they were included all sorts. I spoke at 2 of them. There was a lot of discussion at those about various what you would call conspiracy theory, but of all sorts, on all kinds, and they were very popular. Now, he is also a former chair of the UK 9/11 Truth Campaign, which you and I were involved in, you know, in the very early days, around about 2003, 2004. So he did that for a year. In fact, I think he did an extremely good job as chair of UK 9/11 Truth, but he has been seriously ill with cancer, and I'm really not sure as to his health at the moment, but I did know he had a serious operation this week, and he's just about managed to pull through. I mean, what are your memories of and thoughts about Ian?
Well, as you say, he was a prominent voice at that time, and because he had extensive business experience, he was very good at organising events which made money so that they could be repeated. So, I didn't always agree with all of the views that were expressed at those events when I attended as a participant in some of them. But the point is that freedom of speech means listening to things you don't agree with, and he was very much in favour of that. And I wish him all the best.
He was due to have his next conference the first few days of May this year. Obviously, that won't be happening because of the lockdown. But it's a great loss, I think. And this is one of the things, including things like World Update, the daily weekday program on the BBC, that if these things go, then democracy and freedom actually is denuded by their loss. And in a way, you know, you can't help but feeling that with this conference not being able to go ahead because of the lockdown, without Ian, it doesn't actually need him to go ahead. And without certain shows being aired, particularly interrogative and, investigative programs, conferences, that sort of thing, that freedom is slipping away.
Well, it was always pretty tenuous, and it's slipping away. You're right. And of course,
it's not just freedom. Of course, these are basic human rights. These are basic civil rights that we don't have at the moment.
Well, they're being chipped away bit by bit. And of course, the other thing that's going on, which is very pernicious, is the way that algos are being used by the tech giants to steer people away from the stuff that they need to hear. And that's a very pernicious thing, because it means that people can talk, but nobody can hear them. And it means that people who try to make a living from alternative journalism, which is quite feasible if there was a level playing field, can't do it, which means that then everything is then left to the shills who are paid by the government.
You mean the Bellingcats?
Well, yes, the Bellingcat, the independent Bellingcat, who's funded by the Atlantic Council and the Council for Foreign Relations, but he's an independent journalist. Yeah, people like him.
Also, Martin, one of the stories you sent me this week, the United States is plotting a surprise nuclear attack on Russia and China. That was in the Daily Express. But it's, you know, what it does is it just details the fact that the US really is trying to identify where might be the best place to kill, possibly with a nuclear surprise nuclear attack, the Russian leadership and the Chinese leadership. Now, this is really not acceptable, surely, in international politics, that these kinds of plans are being made for a first strike as a massive power grab to really try and destroy Russia and destroy China. I mean, no one, I think, would accept it if the Americans tried to do that.
Well, the point is that they've been planning. NATO doctrine has always been to not rule out a first strike. The doctrine of both the Russian armed forces, or the Soviet armed forces previously, and the Chinese armed forces has always been, we would never use nuclear weapons first, we've only got them as a deterrent. Most people in Britain are unaware that Britain's policy is to use nuclear weapons first, if we have to. The justification behind it is strategic ambiguity. If the other side doesn't know that you might use them first, it puts them on edge and makes it more difficult for them. And, of course, you could also argue that the Chinese and Russians could say they're not going to use them first, but they could still have a plan to use them first, even though they say they're not going to. Do you follow what I'm saying there? So in a sense, it's nothing we didn't know already. But I think what's significant is that the Express have got that story from Brit intelligence, who are trying to inoculate, vaccinate the population to the possibility that they'll wake up one morning to find that Moscow and Beijing are smoking rubble and we've won World War III, supposedly.
From 1981, the Fun Boy 3, the Lunatics have taken over the asylum. Martin, this week we've had a documentary out called Out of Shadows. This is one of those things that has millions of hits. All the young people share it and watch it. None of the older people watch it. But it's really about the involvement of the Central Intelligence Agency and evil forces, should we call them, cults, in Hollywood and particularly in the news industry. It features Kevin Shipp, who's a former CIA officer. It's made by a stuntman called Mike Smith, and it also features journalist Liz Crokin. Now, Liz was one of the journalists that broke the Pizzagate story a couple of years ago. Pizzagate was really about John Podesta, Tony Podesta, and other very powerful people within the Clinton campaign who were, it seems, and of course you can't absolutely accuse them of this, using code words in emails to discuss procuring children or underage people for sex. And yet this was completely poo-pooed by the entire press. Liz Crokin lost her job as a result of trying to expose this. Is it feasible, do you think, Martin, that the US press can actually do its job? Well, we're talking here about Hollywood, the film industry and the news media.
Well, I've just recently read Seymour Hersh's autobiography called Reporter, and he would argue that you can't. I mean, he's obviously over the years, he's exposed quite a lot of stuff because he's got excellent contacts inside the military. And he says there are people in there who know what's going on and they tell me what's going on and I'm allowed to report it to some extent. But of course, his stuff has had to be put in the London Review of Books because the New York Review of Books won't publish it. And in the book, he says, you know, when I was a young man in the 1960s and 1970s, it was the heyday of investigative journalism. And he said, you can't do that anymore. It's basically being left to amateurs. because the professionals have given up on it.
Well, let's have a listen now to an extract from the new documentary film by Mike Smith, the former stuntman of Hollywood. And it includes, as I said, Kevin Shipp, who I think is actually the first person we're going to hear now. He's a former CIA officer.
Most people don't want to cross the psychological line that this stuff is going on. We all have a mental defense mechanism. It's like finally admitting there's an elite pedophile ring. I mean, most people just don't want to go there. And the same is here. You, psychologically, you lose your safety, your security, and whatever innocence you have when you realize that this stuff is really going on. And it's a chore to cross over that barrier and realize, oh my gosh, this stuff is really happening. And that's why it takes critical thinking. The people have got to look at this stuff critically and see what they're being fed so they can cross that psychological line that they just refuse to see it when it's right in front of them.
When Kevin said there's an elite pedophile ring, well, I'm thinking to myself, this is a hard thing for me to come to terms with. Now, it made me start thinking about conversations and things I'd heard, but I'd never saw it. It's not out in the open. And to me, I was like, no one could do that. Because, I mean, if I saw someone hurting a kid, I would kill them. I mean, I would literally kill them. I would never allow someone to hurt a child in front of me. Things Kevin was saying were things that were hard for me to cross the barrier. I did not want to believe it. I didn't want to go there. But as I went down this journey, I forced myself to go consider, what if this is real? And the only person that was talking about this stuff was a girl named Liz Crokin. And the media had declared her completely out of her mind. But as I started researching some of the things she was reporting on, I was like, there's truth to what she's saying. So I want to talk to her.
I worked in media for over 2 decades, and I never had any issues. I was very well respected. I basically was embraced by the mainstream media until I started reporting on Pizzagate. Now, when Pizzagate came out, the media tried to turn Pizzagate into something that wasn't.
Surprises of the presidential campaign was the explosion of fake news on the internet.
28-year-old Edgar Welch was arrested in Washington Sunday afternoon outside Comet Ping Pong, a popular family pizza parlor. D.C. police say Welch fired at least one round into the restaurant floor with an AR-15 rifle like this one on his Facebook page. No one was injured.
Someone on Twitter, whose name remains unverified but has several thousand followers, posted that new emails found on Anthony Weiner's computer confirmed that Hillary Clinton was involved in a pedophilia ring. The rumor spread, inspiring some newfound internet sleuths to start digging around in John Podesta's hacked emails, searching for proof and location of the so-called sex ring.
In those emails, they are absolutely littered with code words, and many of these code words are food words, such as pizza.
Somebody said to me, hey, Dave, search for pizza in Podesta's emails. And once you go down that rabbit hole, you never really emerge the same person.
It was obvious from the get-go that these words were code words for something else, because the context that they were used in did not make sense.
To be clear, not one single email in the Podesta emails discusses child sex trafficking or pedophilia. That is a fact. But there are dozens of what seem to be strangely worded emails dealing with pizza and handkerchiefs. Investigators say that those words in the emails about pizza and the talk of handkerchiefs is code language used by pedophiles.
There is some kind of code language. They're just not talking about pizza, folks. Who phrases that? Who blocks out an hour of time to eat a slice of pizza?
You can get a service for a half an hour, you can get a massage for a half an hour, but you can't get food for a half an hour. It just absolutely makes no sense.
There's other ones like, the realtor found a handkerchief. I think it has a map that seems pizza-related. And another one is, Obama spent $65,000 flying in pizza and hot dogs from Chicago. Are we using the same channels?
Pizza is a well-known pedophile code word that actually has been used by law enforcement to arrest online sexual predators of children. And there's been multiple arrests that have been made by law enforcement of pedophiles trying to solicit children by using the pedophile code word pizza.
2007, unclassified FBI document. That document, according to the FBI, contains commonly used symbols by pedophiles to express their preference in children. Notice this one on the end, the triangle? That image signifies something called boy love. The pizza place next door to Comet Ping Pong Pizza, Vesta Pizza, well, this was their logo until only a few weeks ago.
People don't know that because the mainstream media refuses to cover it.
The entire mainstream media redefined what Pizzagate was to make it sound ridiculous and less believable. And then they had people like Megyn Kelly come in, interview James Elefantis, didn't ask him any challenging questions.
A conspiracy theory that even the DC police say has no basis in fact.
She didn't ask him any questions about the pictures of children on his Instagram page looking abused, being sexualized. She didn't ask him about the pedophile talk. So the whole mainstream media painted him as this poor victim, as this person that was innocent, that was just victimized, as something that wasn't true. But just his Instagram page alone should have been enough for authorities to look into him.
So that's a clip from Out of Shadows, a film made by Mike Smith, former stuntman of Hollywood. Also you heard there Liz Crokin, the journalist who was sacked because of her exposing the Pizzagate scandal, along with the emails which were leaked by WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, bless him, and also Kevin Shipp, former CIA officer, Martin. But, I mean, this idea of looking at Hollywood as infiltrated by evil cults, people who have got very peculiar ideas and even have pictures, as the Podestas allegedly do, of child sex scenes, well, scenes that appear to be some sort of abuse of children in their homes, and they're commissioning art based on those kind of hideous ideas.
Well, the use of paedophilia as a tool of the deep state is well documented in all sorts of situations. If you're going to compromise people, it's money, ideology, coercion, ego. And of course, coercion can be used against people who've been, who are involved with sex with children because it's illegal and all the rest of it. You can't blackmail people anymore about having affairs outside marriage or having same-sex relationships, but you can certainly blackmail them about having sex with children. So that's the obvious reason why they do this. The other thing is that human nature, being what it is, power over other people, especially, is part of the buzz of being a powerful person. And it's easy to corrupt people on that basis.
He touches on the whole Jeffrey Epstein scandal in that, and it was that erupted the end of last year as they were making the film. So Epstein, you know, features very heavily. He's also, by the way, somebody who was on the Epstein's Lolita Express private jet. The name Bill Gates keeps creeping up. He made several visits to Epstein's Orgy Island.
Well, why am I not surprised? The point that Epstein's task, as I perceive it, as a Mossad agent of influence, is to entrap as many different people as possible who've got important positions of authority or power or money, and of course that all of that goes straight back to Tel Aviv, and they've got it all in the files, and when they want favours or they want to intimidate people, it's all there to go.
Well, the Gates family is also in Skull and Bones, as we're about to hear from the author of Fleshing Out Skull and Bones. And for those that don't know what Skull and Bones is, Martin, maybe you could describe it. I've seen that it seems to have been created in the 1800s based around the opium trade as a sort of small group, originally a small criminal group of people who were involved in the opium trade, and they were used by governments, they were used by people like the East India Company and people like that, something called the Russell Trust, set up this as a kind of cult in the US at Yale University in order to make sure that these secret deals to do with opium, shipping opium, growing opium, making money from opium, were all kept secret. But what's your take on Skull and Bones?
Well, the ruling classes have always had elite groups to which only they have access. So, I mean, in a simple way, you can think that the Order of the Garter, founded by Edward III in this country, you know, it still exists. Only certain people are allowed in it. It's relatively public. But they've always got these kind of clubs that they belong to, you know, the Reform Club, whatever it is. Skull and Bones is a particularly powerful such group, which has formed in the 1800s, as you say, and virtually anybody who's in anybody in the US establishment has been in it. And in fact, those who haven't been in it aren't in the establishment.
But it's, okay, well, Chris Mulligan talks about the Bush crime family being one of the families at the heart of that. Of course, we've had two US presidents from this Bush crime family, both from Skull and Bones too.
Yes, and the grandfather, Prescott Bush, was a very important person in Skull and Bones back in the beginning of the 20th century. And he, of course, tried to overthrow Roosevelt with a military coup and was eventually arrested for trading with the enemy during World War II because he was basically pro-Nazi. And that's George Bush's grandfather.
So let's have a listen now to publisher Chris Mulligan. He's also the author of the book Fleshing Out Skull and Bones, speaking to me from Oregon in the United States earlier this week.
You know, it gets down to my thesis of what's been happening in that, you know, the teens and the preteens in America in 1860s didn't cohere because of the assassination of a president, war, and opium. Okay, they were the civics generation. Okay, they tried to do that again to the kids that were teens and preteens in the 1960s, and they were the idealistic generation. And we weren't supposed to cohere, the boomers weren't supposed to cohere, but we did cohere around a joint being smoked around a circle with a little bit of LSD thrown in. Because LSD can be used to disrupt, but it can't be used to control like opium can. And out of the hippies, you know, and not just here in America, but the whole world over, came the personal computer and the internet. And those are the tools that we as a people are using to fight the corruption of these people using secrecy to lie, cheat, and steal. And so I'm sure Gates is compromised. And he comes from a family. I mean, there's a Gates in Skull and Bones, too. You know, and he's part of that family. But again, you're still going to compromise these people. I see that we have an opportunity here that is presented to us from God, excuse my language, by this paradigm shift. We have to have honest elections. I mean, the technology, blockchain technology and other technology is here so that we can have honest elections. Because, you know, we haven't had an honest election here in the United States. I mean, as far as from my reading of the whole situation, Trump didn't really even get elected. I mean, he was put in by the powers that be. They used the same machines that used to get Bernie out then to put, because Clintons were, they're just lieutenants. I mean, they're just lieutenants in the Bush crime family. And so I look at these guys doing, you know, very long-term things, but there's some things that they can control at time and there's some things that they can't. And they aren't going to let a crisis go to waste, but here's how the secret societies run the world. They've got, you know, top levels, mining, metal, and money. Okay, they hold that very tight. And then they've got the very active thing, drugs, guns, and oil. And then where this Leviathan meets the level is media, movie / music, and quote-unquote magic. So the op is to flip that bottom, to flip that bottom. Magic is their ability to hoodwink us and their preponderance on using mass trauma rituals to keep us in line. I mean, the Kennedy assassination and 9/11 at their core are mass trauma rituals. And these people, they believe that what they perform is a thing called death magic. They kill people and they get power. There's people in Hollywood that are so pissed off over the control that is done over them. You know, and I'm a musician and, you know, we're beyond pissed off. And the media, right now, not everybody is a card-carrying bad person, okay? But those things can be flipped. They have to give the media rein. They have to give them a long lead. They always try and make it think that, you know, they're in total control. Well, they aren't in total control. They're helping set up some things now and then that bounce some things around, but they aren't in control, especially during times like these. So I'm hoping for the best, and I think that government of the people, by the people, and for the people can happen.
Flipping the base, Martin. Chris Mulligan there, Flipping the Base. He's the author of Fleshing Out Skull and Bones, speaking to me from Oregon earlier this week. But when he says that, what he's saying effectively is where the elite meets the population, and he's talking largely about media there, that they've got to have quite a bit of rein, and that is the only real way that we'll regain freedom, regain democracy, is by actually regaining control of the media. And he's also saying there that actually the internet is one of the only places to do that. So anyway, what do you make of the idea of whether or not the media can be used for good rather than taken over, monopolized, bought up by banksters and used to lie to us?
Well, I suppose the media can be used for good, otherwise we wouldn't be here trying to create a media product, which we hope somebody will listen to. Otherwise, what's the point? I mean, insofar as I get a chance to say things in the media, then we've got to use them. What we've got to do is we've got to infiltrate all society's institutions and turn them round so that they serve people instead of the oligarchy. And that is the real struggle. And of course,
that's what he's saying there is that's the op. That's what he says.
That goes for any institution, the media, the military, the police, any institution can be turned. And of course, just as they're using their tentacles to reach out into the society and try and control us, we can use the same techniques to try and control them. And that's the battle.
So I think we'll finish this week by looking at an article by Robert Bridge, who was, I'm not sure if he still is, he certainly was a writer for Russia Today, and he actually worked in Moscow for them. His article is Bill Gates Crosses the Digital Rubicon. He says mass gatherings may not return without a global vaccine. So amazingly, this guy didn't even get a college degree, but made lots and lots of money, and his father was involved in the Planned Parenthood. Many people say eugenicists, family, others say Malthusians. We mentioned that a bit last week. But anyway, Robert says here, a recurring theme amongst conspiracy theorists is that the elite are just waiting for the right moment to roll out their Mark of the Beast technology to remotely identify and control every single human being on the planet, thus sealing their plans for a one-world government. And with many people willing to do so, just about anything, just to get back some sense of normalcy, those fears appear more justified with each passing day. In the book of Revelation, he says, 13:16-7, there is a passage that's attracted the imagination of believers and unbelievers throughout the ages, perhaps even more so right now. He causeth all, both great and small, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark in their right hand or in their foreheads, that no man might buy or sell save he had that mark. And then this is the line I love, Martin, is, was John of Patmos history's first conspiracy theorist? Or are we merely indulging ourselves today with the case of self-fulfilling prophecy? But anyway, I'll put a link up to that article on our show page. I suppose this is, I mean, you were arguing with me last week, Martin, about this, and it seems that Robert Bridge would agree with you that the ultimate aim here is some kind of implantable chip. It's not just a kind of ID card with an electronic ID, like a passport.
Yeah, I mean, I think they definitely are going for that. What that has to do with the rather weird trip of John of Patmos some hundreds of years ago, I suppose what it has to do with that is that that's there in the cultural zeitgeist. So they may have got the idea from that, but I don't believe that anything is set in stone. But they definitely are planning a panopticon planet, to use the phrase from Foucault and from Bentham. They want to be able to see everything in real time so that they can control it. And that's their wet dream.
I mean, that is almost like they do see themselves as God. You know, the idea that the eye in the sky is watching you. And actually, it's an electronic eye. It's not a spiritual eye, a creator, a God.
Well, they see themselves as the philosopher kings. That God works through them. Because they see people like Bill Gates, who are such geniuses with technology, who are able to revolutionize the way we do business. They should be in charge, surely. I mean, we're fools if we don't recognize how important they are, and that without them, we'd be nowhere. And of course, you can see this sort of delusion is very much underpinning this kind of attitude. And, you know, powerful people get used to being powerful, and they think it's a good thing because they think it's a good thing, and nothing's really changed in history. It's always been the same.
The way I see it, wealth brings you various things. It brings you second homes, third, fourth, fifth, sixth homes, private jets, yachts, you know, all those sorts of things. And then once you're making far too much money to buy all those things, even more money, you start to want to buy up any kind of institution that might oppose you. And that, of course, includes a free press and any kind of elected parliament, Martin.
Well, it does. And I think ultimately it's not really about money. It's about power. Money is just the means of keeping the score. Now, so, for example, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which is tax exempt, don't forget. So he can take his profits and stick it in it. He can then fund all of his private projects tax free. And then those private projects that he's funding, free vaccinations for people, which a lot of which have turned out in the third world to be really, really iffy. So they're actually injecting people with experimental vaccines, and not just experimental vaccines which cause infertility. Big scandal about that in Kenya, where Gates vaccines have caused infertility in lots and lots of people that they gave them to. And basically, they are megalomaniacs and psychopaths. And those are the kind of people that rise to the top in a hierarchical competitive system like modern late capitalism. Those are the kind of people who end up running it.
Is it like the fall of Rome? Is it comparable, do you think?
It's comparable, but the fall of Rome was a relatively minor event compared to what we're dealing with now. Don't forget, the population of the entire planet was only about a medium-sized city in modern China. So the fall of Rome, although it's had a great influence on events subsequently, you know, it's the Roman Empire never went away. It's always been there as a kind of ideal state that we want to. I mean, the whole constitution of the US is based on the Roman Empire, not on Athenian democracy, where they didn't have an upper house. The Senate is designed to be an upper house of older, wealthier people to keep the Democrats in control. And that's how it was designed in the 18th century, officially modeled on the Roman Empire, not on the Athenian democracy. And that is the world we live in, and we're haunted by the past.
Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guests, Irina Bondarouk from Shirehampton, Dr. Judith Brown, also Bill Steele, the Steele Report, reading out Robert Kennedy's attack, really, I suppose, expose of all the disasters that Bill Gates has created with his vaccine program, Martin was just referring to there, around the world. Also, thanks to Mike Smith, producer and director of Out of Shadows, the film there, and also to publisher from Oregon, author of Fleshing Out Skull and Bones, Chris Mulligan. Thanks also to Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Download our MP3s and you can listen in the car or anywhere you like. You'll find this show's podcast, story links and comment page and our contact details at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. I'll be back in the UK, God willing, next week. Do please join us for the BCFM Emergency Schedule Politics Show online on Friday or on FM, hopefully, if the other side download it and upload the file into the playout system. as we've been promised they will, at 10 p.m. on Mondays. God bless. And don't let the banksters get you down.